Greetings, friends. This is a Dhamma talk on the Buddha's meaning of awakening as awakening relates to the Fourth Noble Truth. This talk is the fourth of four talks on awakening to the Four Noble Truths. This talk was presented at our Wednesday evening Dhamma class in Flemington, New Jersey on August 26, 2015. I hope you find benefit from this talk. Peace. So I'm starting about a quarter of the way into this article, if you happen to read it, but the previous part of that we talked about last week and just tonight. So these are the words of the Buddha, and he's describing his path to awakening. And this is the noble truth to the way of practice leading to the cessation of dukkha, precisely this noble eightfold path. Then he describes it. Right view is the first factor. Right view is understanding the origins of suffering, origins of dukkha. And that's our entry point also into the Dhamma. Right view is accepting, at least on a very mundane and surface level, that the Four Noble Truths make some sense to me. And I'm going to engage in this to make some more sense out of it. Right view is the beginning of inclining the mind towards awakening. I'm going to skip around a little bit, just for time's sake. The second factor of the Eightfold Path is right intention. And if you remember what the origination of dukkha is, the second noble truth is that craving and clinging is the origination of dukkha. It's also the proliferation of dukkha. Then right intention is having the intention of renunciation to abandon craving and clinging. Right intention is having the intention to remain free of ill will, or having the intention to remain harmless. Right intention is mindfully turning away from the things leading to stress and confusion and mindfully engaging and integrating the Eightfold Path. When the Buddha taught mindfulness, he taught it in two very refined ways. One is in the Satipatthana Sutta that I think I talked about last week, and the other is in relation to the Eightfold Path. In other words, in relation to right intention, the Buddha taught to be mindful when engaged in wrong intention and enter and remain into right intention. Be mindful of that. It means to hold in mind. It means that we should apply our thought process in a clear way to staying in these things that lead to awakening. Does that make sense? The third part of the Eightfold Path is right speech, and that's abstaining from lying, abstaining from divisive speech, abstaining from harmful speech, abstaining from idle chatter, and gossip, saying only what's necessary. Being mindful of right speech develops a deep awareness of thoughts, words, and deeds that would further cause stress and confusion. Right speech is free of grasping, clinging, aversion, or expressing wrong views. As one develops a meditation practice within this broader view of a broader framework of the Eightfold Path, right speech and action and livelihood are so helpful in recognizing where craving and clinging arises. It's through our speech and actions that we can see what we're attaching ourselves to and what we're craving after. And probably the most important aspect of right speech is not what we're saying to others, but self-talk. What are we saying to ourselves? And we can very clearly see, if we're willing to look at that, the clinging that we use to create an ego self. And it's that type of clinging that we begin to unravel through this Dhamma. Right action is similar to right speech. It's abstaining from taking life, abstaining from stealing, abstaining from sexual misconduct. As with right speech, right action is free of any self-centered desire and leads to the development of harmony and equanimity. Right livelihood is abstaining from a dishonest livelihood, not engaging in what can cause harm to others, avoiding the sale of intoxicants, and now I used to say avoiding the sale of illicit drugs, enhancing life with right livelihood. Right livelihood is specifically remaining harmless in the manner of earning a living and contributing to the common good. So you see how this all really fits together to support one common purpose, which is to awaken. There's nothing, I've never come across anything unnecessary or frivolous in what the Buddha taught. I've come across it in other Buddhist religions, and again, I'm not putting them down. There's nothing extraneous. Every word that came out of the Buddha's mouth had a purpose, and the purpose was human awakening. Right effort, the sixth factor, is generating effort and intention to abandon cultivation of unskillful qualities. Right? Abandon the intention to continue in unskillful ways. Generate the effort and intention to abandon unskillful qualities that are present. Right effort is generating effort and intention to cultivate skillful qualities. And what are skillful qualities? Right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And then the skills of right mindfulness and right meditation. Right effort is integrating all eight factors of the Eightfold Path into one's life. And so what does that mean? It means, and it leads to the next factor, it means that we consciously develop the mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. We see our lives in relation to the Eightfold Path. And this happens almost as a natural consequence of meditation and being mindful of these factors. Norma and I talked a little bit about that. Norma. There was a young girl in class last night, but of course, Lorna and I talked about this a little bit earlier. It seems to come on us gradually, but we realize that I'm seeing my life differently, and I'm seeing it within this framework of the Eightfold Path, and that's why it's so important. Why? Because it shows us our craving and clinging. It shows us the further continuance of our ego personality at work in the world, and for the sole purpose of recognizing it and unraveling it. Right mindfulness is holding in mind what is occurring in one's life and the qualities of awakening in relation to the Four Noble Truths. And then I talk a little bit about the Satipatthana Sutta in this article, but I won't go into it again. And then I mentioned it a little bit earlier. In relation to the Eightfold Path, right mindfulness is remaining mindful of all eight factors of the Eightfold Path and doing something about it. It's not enough to just be mindful that I'm engaged in wrong speech. It's actually adjusting that speech, but also to be mindful of the importance of maintaining right view. So at a initial stage, holding on to that right view is the view that I'm engaged in this practice to change the way that I think, to let go of clinging. And then as clinging and craving arises, we recognize it. And that leads back to that second factor, right intention. I see it, I'm going to let it go. And there's nothing else to do with clinging. And as we consciously let go of clinging, it's likely that our conditioned mind is going to bring that same type of clinging back up. We recognize it and create the strong intention to not engage in that anymore. And over time, all clinging falls aside. What that leads to is the clinging that is necessary to maintain an ego personality. And eventually we unravel that. I'm not going to get into the next thing because it would just be more confusing at this point. Right meditation is meditation that develops two qualities, tranquility and insight. These are the Buddha's words. In the Visaya Sutta, the Buddha describes the two qualities of right meditation. These two qualities have a share in clear knowing, and which two are they? Tranquility, shamatha, and insight, vipassana. When tranquility is developed, what purpose does it serve? The mind is developed, and when the mind is developed, what purpose does that serve? Passion or clinging, craving is abandoned. As we develop a deeper level of concentration, we gain the ability to recognize where clinging is driving our lives, and we can abandon it. When insight is developed, what purpose does it serve? Discernment is developed, and when discernment is developed, what purpose does that serve? Ignorance is abandoned. Defiled by passion, the mind is not released. Defiled by ignorance, discernment does not develop. It's just a mind rooted in ignorance is inclined towards continued ignorance. Right? Makes sense? In fact, a mind, an unawakened mind, a deluded mind, is dependent, just like dependent origination states, on continued ignorance. And we can do that in all types of ways. We can do it with spiritual practices that don't lead to unbinding, so-called spiritual practices, because they just continue distraction. Thus, from the fading of passion is there awareness, release. From the fading of ignorance, there is discernment release, meaning that awareness of clinging leads to the release. We have to be mindful of it first. In the Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha describes a level of meditative absorption developed. Well, I'm having trouble talking tonight with Shamatha Vipassana meditation, and I think I've gone far enough tonight. But I mentioned the jhanas. The jhanas are four levels of meditative absorption that we all experience if we're engaged in a right meditation method, which is Shamatha Vipassana meditation. And some of the later developed schools, and certainly in the Vipassana tradition, the jhanas are made are overemphasized and made much more esoteric and mystical than they need to be. So the jhanas are just levels of meditative absorption, like I said, that we all experience. The first level of meditative absorption is just to recognize that your mind is quiet. Let me read that part on it. So the first jhana, remaining free of distraction by sensuality and sense contact, remaining free of distraction by unskillful mental qualities, remaining free of distraction by sensuality and sense contact, remaining free of distraction by unskillful mental qualities, and entering and remaining in the first jhana, which is rapture and pleasure developed through samadhi, through a non-distracted state. And every time that we recognize that we're caught up in our thinking and bring our mindfulness back to the sensation of breathing, we're experiencing that non-distracted state. Initially, it might only last for a moment or two. It might even be imperceptible, but it's there. And every time we do it, we're building on that initial experience of being mindful of the breath in the body, of samadhi, of a non-distracted state. So the goal is an ongoing mind of equanimity, a mind that rests in samadhi. But we build on that, those little bits of meditative absorption that's described. Now, in some of the literature, not related to the Pali Canon, it'll place even this level of jhana unreachable for most people. You have to go through all these special types of trainings. And again, nothing that the Buddha taught. These are things for human beings to develop and that we can develop by just engaging in this practice. So again, going back to that, the first level is rapture and pleasure born from samadhi, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. That means insight. And the directed thought is just a thought that I'm caught up in my thinking again. I'm coming back to my breath. It's simply directed thought. It's an aspect of being mindful, the refined type of mindfulness, pointing us back to the sensation of breathing. With a tranquil mind, entering and remaining in the second jhana, rapture and pleasure born of samadhi. And this is, now it's developing a little deeper level of mindfulness and concentration. Unification of awareness free from directed thought and evaluation, resting in an internal assurance. We're having developed moments of mindfulness of the breath without having to concern ourselves with it, without having to direct ourselves back to our breath. We stay with the breath for a few more moments. That's the second level of jhana. And that deepens, that second level deepens. But we've all experienced that every time we've meditated with the correct method. So the point that I'm making about the jhanas, it's not so much about how long we experience each level, it's that we can experience it. We can achieve these levels. I lost my place. With the fading of rapture, remaining equanimous, mindful and alert, gaining pleasure with the sensation of breathing in the body, again, pointing back to the first jhana, entering and remaining, let me comment on that too. One of the things that drives our practice as we deepen our practice is the pleasure that we get out of our practice. And this is a skillful pleasure. The word that's usually used to describe that is chanda, a skillful desire. It's good to have that. We're experiencing some initial benefit. It just feels good. And use that pleasure to drive our practice. Be mindful of it. this is a good thing. The developing release from clinging is a wonderful experience, and it should be acknowledged, and it's part of the third jhana. And I think I asked this question last night. We had maybe 12 or 13 people. Has anybody felt this? And everybody's, you know, everybody. We've all felt that, even if it's just for a brief moment. We've had this experience of the jhana, of the level of meditative absorption. And this third level is equanimous and mindful, and it's a pleasant abiding. We have some, it just feels good, like I just talked about. Abandoning pleasure and pain due to the renunciation of pleasure and pain, that means right intention. Entering and remaining in the fourth jhana, purity of equanimity and mindfulness, there's neither pleasure nor pain. It's just a feeling of complete freedom. The mind is at peace. And when the Buddha described the awakened mind, he described it as being unbound and free and luminous. In another sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, he described that mind as without any borders, which is really the same thing as unbound, but he used a little bit more emphasis on that. Our minds are not restricted anymore by our own clinging. That's what he's pointing to. So I had to talk about the jhanas because I mentioned it. We experience that, and it's important to acknowledge it every time we meditate, and that experience of the jhanas deepens as we develop our meditation practice within the broader framework. So I've talked a long time tonight, probably too long, but are there any questions about what I talked about tonight?
Yeah.
I hope it wasn't too much.
But this is also included in one of the articles, so...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is... Well, when you go to the website, on the left-hand side, it'll say Awakening to the Fourth Noble Truth. And the last... all four talks this month have been on Awakening to the... So all of those articles and three of the talks are up there, so you can listen to it. And again, I hope... I consider this... when I decide what I'm going to teach and how I'm going to teach it, that I don't want this to be more confusing and to give out too much information. But if you remember that all of this is in context of the Four Noble Truths, it tends to keep it down on the human level that it needs to be. In other words, I mentioned before that the jhanas have been used to create this mystical and esoteric type of Buddhism when it was never the intention. It's just to acknowledge that there's levels of meditative absorption that we all go through. And we, whether we recognize it, whether we do it tonight or some other time, they occur. You know, they occur.
And so the jhanas are just levels of meditation.
That's all. Okay. That's all. And I guess the reason why I'm saying this is, as we, it's natural as we develop an understanding of the Buddha's teachings to want to look at other teachings, and so you may come across this. And in many ways, the jhanas are taught in a way or presented in a way that they're accomplishments. And when we start looking at our meditation that way, rather than just to develop deep concentration and insight, then we can become very frustrated with our meditation. And it starts creating, this is getting a little bit psychological, but it starts creating an identity. I have achieved the second level. So what? You know? Even if you've achieved the fourth level and you've been able to maintain it, that's just what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to awaken, you know. There's no reason to create any additional identities about our achievements in meditation.
That's a silly question. Once you have achieved the fourth level, you're able to maintain that through your life, through your day, through all your actions.
Likely not initially.
Okay. No, but down the road, once you... I mean, if you do this long enough, then...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Again, the Buddha described the awakened mind as a mind resting in equanimity, unbound, okay. You know, luminous. If you compare it to an unawakened, confused mind, that unawakened, confused mind is agitated and usually easily given to more agitation. It's reactive. So the opposite
welcome
of
to
that.
My world.
Pardon me? Yeah, well,
welcome to, my world.
Welcome to the human world. That's the common human problem. But it's probably part of that that drove you to come here.
Oh, absolutely.
That's skillful desire, that's an element. That's an element of inner wisdom. That's driving all of us. You know, I didn't take up the Dhamma because my life was so wonderful and I had everything under control. There was something missing. I think that's why most people come to this. We just recognize there's something's not quite right. I'm not seeing things right. There's something missing from my life. And what's missing is a real experience of life as it occurs, rather than being driven by desire, driven by clinging. So thank you for saying that. Susan.
What I struggle with, first of all, thank you for always explaining things because I need to hear it after we read it to really understand
yeah.
it. And you do such a nice job.
Thank you.
So I just want to thank you for that. And now, what I struggle with, and maybe it's just because of what I've done in my career, maybe, but how does this integrate with being self-reliant and setting goals and achieving goals? How does that integrate, or can it not integrate with that?
It does integrate, but as your understanding of the Eightfold Path as the framework of your life, then you would bring those goals and aspirations within that framework. And does it fit in? Is it part of right view and right intention that I'd be doing this? And it does not mean that we shouldn't have goals, but they should be within the framework of right speech, action, and livelihood. And we should see the goal as not continuing to reinforce my ego personality. So the Buddha was an awakened human being, wasn't he? And for the last 45 years of his life, every day he had a goal. It was a pretty simple goal, but pretty profound, was to teach the Dhamma. He had a purpose in his life, and he continued on that purpose. You know. There were other awakened beings that awakened because of the Buddha's direct teachings. Anathapindika is one that comes to mind, who was a very wealthy merchant, made his money over the Silk Road. He didn't renounce that. He continued to maintain his lifestyle and his goals, but he did it as an awakened human being. It's a common...
I think I may have even asked you this before.
Well, that's
sorry.
Well, I was going to say...
I remember your answer.
It's a common question, it's often recurring, because when we start understanding even a little bit the ramifications of these teachings, which is letting go of an ego personality, the question then is, well, what's going to happen to me? And the best description and explanation of that I can come up with is the Buddha. The Buddha let go of his ego personality. He awakened to the true nature of reality in this phenomenal world. And he spent 45 years as, well, I think, the most effective human being the world has ever seen, certainly teaching the truth. So we're not annihilated, but we feel like we are because we have a strong identity of our ego personality as being the sum of our parts.
So if I had a professional goal, but it was to better serve people, that would... long as I didn't identify my worth based on that,
yep.
that would be in line?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful.
Thank you for asking the question. It's so important. You know, we could be, as an individual, I could be sitting on the biggest pile of money that you could imagine. But as long as I don't identify with myself to that and need that to describe who I am, it's just money. It's just a pile of cash. The best way that I can put that into perspective is we all left our homes today and came here into this room to learn a little bit more about the Dhamma. We didn't have to bring all of our possessions with us. You know, we didn't have to bring everything we own and the kids and the dogs and the cats and the goldfish and bring them here with us in order to maintain them in our lives. but they're still there. We don't have to hold on to anything to maintain it. And we don't have to chase after goals to feed our view of who we think we are. But again, it doesn't mean that we don't do things. There's nothing wrong with improving your position in your business, whatever it might be. But is your ego based on it? Are you going to use that to describe yourself to yourself and to other people? And again, there's nothing really wrong with that, except it's going to lead to more confusion and suffering. It's more establishing, in the Buddhist terms, it's more eye-making, which is the big problem. When we let go of all eye-making, we live lives of lasting peace and happiness. We're still living here. There's some Buddhist traditions that talk about when you awaken, poof, you're gone somehow. It's ludicrous. When you go back to the fount, to the teacher, there's the Buddha. He awakened. He spent 45 years doing his thing, We don't have to be concerned with annihilation, but when it comes up, recognize that it's an aspect of your ego personality, saying, wait a minute, I don't want any of this. Just recognize it. Let it go and come back to the Dhamma. People talk about fear that arises during meditation. Fear is always attached to that, to the ego personality crying out in fear. What's becoming of me? You're letting go of me? Well, good. It's only the ego personality that's prone to confusion and suffering, and that's all we're letting go of. We're not letting go of anything that has any useful substance at all, any substantial nature. Good questions. Thank you. Did that lead to any other questions, though? It's the essence of the Dhamma to recognize and let go of all views that perpetuate anatta, the ego personality. And if that seems overwhelming, you don't have to do it all at once. It's a process. Dependent origination describes that process. And so what we're doing is unraveling that process that from ignorance through 12 causative links suffering arises. And we're doing that by gaining wisdom, by seeing things clearly. So let's meditate before it gets too late. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.